Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. I am Gail Seiler, your host for today. Thanks for tuning in. Wheatsfield Co-op in Ames has a program called Change for Community. When you check out, you have the option of rounding up to the nearest dollar and donate that money to the monthly Change for Community recipient. And this month, that recipient is KHOI. So when you are checking out at Wheatsfield, please remember KHOI and say yes to contribute to Change for the Community. We're not having our usual weather report today because we all know what it's going to be, wet. But we do have Dennis Hart. Dennis has been bringing us a news summary several times a week. He is now in California, but he continues to comb the Iowa news outlets and is now submitting his news roundup from afar.
Thanks very much. It's good to be back here on Local Talk on Mondays. President Trump is going to come to Iowa tomorrow, Tuesday, for a rally in Council Bluffs, where he is expected to announce year-round access to gasoline with 15% ethanol. The event is scheduled to take place at 6:30 tomorrow night at the Mid-America Center. The increased use of ethanol would be a help to Iowa corn farmers, especially considering a slump in crop prices that has not been helped by the Trump administration's trade battles with China. Meanwhile, word came that Canada has agreed to join the U.S. and Mexico in a trade deal that will replace the North American Free Trade Agreement. That deal will provide the United States with greater access to Canada's dairy market. Iowa Republican lawmakers praised the deal and an earlier one with Mexico, which they said would give farmers and manufacturers market certainty in those countries. Former Iowa Governor Terry Branstad said last week that China has used the United States' own free press to bully American workers, farmers, and businesses over the issue of trade. Branstad's commentary appeared in the Des Moines Register. He said a recent advertising supplement that ran in the Register doubles down on Chinese retaliation against the U.S. for fighting against what Branstad calls Beijing's unfair trade policies. China has slapped $250 billion on tariffs in response to American tariffs that began last spring. Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley said he plans to take part in the president's $12 billion farm bailout program that's intended to cushion the negative effects of trade tariffs on the prices of farm commodities. Grassley is a lifelong farmer in Butler County in the northeast part of the state. Grassley said he won't know how much federal money he will receive until his crops are harvested and records are taken to a Farm Service Agency office to find out. The senator said he's taken part in federal farm programs since his father died in 1960 when he took over the family's farming operation. Meanwhile, three women were arrested Friday night after they refused to leave Senator Grassley's Des Moines office. The women said they were sexual assault survivors and wanted to talk to Grassley to convince him to vote against Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court. On Saturday, Grassley voted to confirm Kavanaugh. And one more note involving Senator Grassley. He suggested last week that the possible reason there are no female Republicans on his Senate Judiciary Committee is because it's a lot of work. But he added later, it's a lot of work for everyone, and that the average female senator, in his words, probably works harder than the average man. Still on politics, U.S. Senator Cory Booker fired up Democrats in Des Moines on Saturday night with a rousing call to get their party and country back on track. The New Jersey Democrat, who is a possible 2020 presidential candidate, appeared at a fundraiser for the state party. Booker gained prominence in recent weeks as a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, where he grilled Brett Kavanaugh during the hearings to determine Kavanaugh's qualifications to be on the Supreme Court. Also last week, Iowa Democratic gubernatorial candidate Fred Hubbell said that state voters do not need more information about his personal finances, in spite of critics' complaints about his refusal to release his full tax returns. Hubbell told the Des Moines Register that his disclosure this past August of a three-page summary of last year's federal and state tax returns was sufficient. Hubbell's Republican opponent, Governor Kim Reynolds, has released 10 years of her full income tax returns. Meanwhile, there was word that White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders will be a guest speaker at Governor Reynolds' second annual Harvest Festival at the Iowa State Fairgrounds this coming Saturday, October 13th. A recent Iowa poll showed Reynolds and Hubbell in a virtual dead heat with about one-third of Iowa voters saying they did not know enough about Hubbell to form an opinion. There was also word last week that more than half of Iowa adults think the state's new fetal heartbeat abortion limit goes too far. That's according to a new Des Moines Register-MediaCom Iowa poll. The poll shows that 52% of Iowans believe the law goes too far, while 39% think it's appropriate. 10% are not sure. The law would ban most abortions and is among the strictest abortion limits in the United States. Also last week, a prosecutor said that the lawyer for the Ames man accused of killing Iowa State student Celia Barkin Arosemena has a potential conflict of interest, and the prosecutor asked a judge to hold a hearing on that alleged conflict and to keep the news media from attending. A hearing date has been set for this coming Friday. Meanwhile, the arraignment for Colin Richards, who was accused of killing Barkin Arosemena, was delayed from this coming Friday to next Monday. And in a separate development, the city of Ames was clearing trees and brush last week from a trail next to the golf course where Barkin Arosemena was killed. That trail is near the homeless camp in which suspect Richards was living. Ames Parks and Recreation Superintendent Joshua Thompson said that increasing the visibility along the path would help trail users be more aware of their surroundings. Also last week, lawyers for the man accused of killing University of Iowa student Molly Tibbetts said that prosecutors must tell them what specific actions he's accused of taking to kill her. Christian Bahena Rivera's lawyer said the details included in the documents charging Rivera with first-degree murder do not offer enough information for them to mount a defense in his case. Rivera has pleaded not guilty to killing Tibbetts. One more note last week about Molly Tibbetts, word that members of the Brooklyn community and beyond came together for a memorial run to honor her. Hundreds of runners took part, many of them wearing T-shirts with a printed message, hashtag Miles for Molly, honoring the woman who was killed while she was jogging this past summer. One of the participants said, "This is what Molly would have wanted." Meanwhile, officials at a pair of central Iowa school districts warned parents last week after strangers tried to lure female students into vehicles near school buildings. One of the incidents took place last Wednesday when a female and two males in a silver vehicle approached a female student outside Monroe Elementary School in the Prairie City Monroe Community School District and told her they had been asked to take her home by a parent. Then last Thursday, a man tried to lure a female student from Harding Middle School in Des Moines into his vehicle. Neither child climbed into the vehicle, and both of them notified authorities. Also last week, a 30-year-old man was accused of sexually abusing at least two juvenile boys when he took several children camping in Story County. Michael Travis Ferguson, who is already registered as a sex offender in Iowa, was arrested on charges he abused the boys between May 2017 and February 2018 at Hickory Grove Park in Colo. When he was arrested in Ohio, he said he lived in that state, but Iowa's sex offender registry listed him as living in Nevada. And last week, police in Perry reported vandalism outside the high school, the same day and location of the community's Latino festival. Someone had spray-painted "Report Illegals" with a phone number outside the school's main entrance. Investigators were looking at surveillance footage to identify any vehicles or people who might have been connected with the incident. There was also word last week that authorities arrested a Council Bluffs man who was accused of threatening to kill the city's mayor. Police said an officer who was sent to Mayor Matt Walsh's City Hall office heard 33-year-old Chase Points screaming expletives. Also last week, an African-American driver who videotaped an officer who he said had pulled him over without reason will be paid $25,000 to settle a lawsuit in a case that critics say provides more evidence of racial profiling within the Des Moines Police Department. 41-year-old Lonnie Porter of Des Moines was never issued a citation during the 8-minute stop. The officer who pulled him over said he made the stop because a temporary license on the vehicle was not fully visible, but the video showed a paper license, which is common in a new vehicle purchase, was displayed in the back window. And there was word last week that a Des Moines man tried to use counterfeit money at a Des Moines convenience store 3 times in the span of 2 hours. He went to jail. Police said 39-year-old Terrell Jerome Burton tried using $5 bills to buy various things, including a lottery ticket. He faces 7 forgery charges. There was much more news in Iowa last week, of course, including a report that 2 Des Moines homeowners have sued the Hubble Realty Company. They claim the company improperly built their homes, causing water to inundate their basements during a storm in June. Thomas and Amy Donnelly allege that Hubble and its contractor, the McClure Engineering Company, failed to properly develop their townhome to prevent flooding, that they built the homes in an area they knew would flood, and that they built them without proper protections against stormwater runoff. In a statement, a Hubble spokesperson said, "New developments and homes are not designed to withstand all extreme weather conditions." Meanwhile, UPS announced last week that it will hire more than 300 seasonal workers in Des Moines as it gears up for the busy holiday season. Nationally, the company expects to hire 200,000 seasonal workers for positions that will last until January. Those seasonal jobs have traditionally been an entryway into permanent employment at UPS. In Indianola, consultants from the Iowa Economic Development Authority unveiled their assessment of the town square and said it needs to become a downtown destination. They said that includes making the area much less about cars and much more about people and their shopping experience. And they said one of the priorities should be converting one-way streets around the square into two-way streets, redesigning crosswalks, and updating the streetscape to make the area more pedestrian-friendly. And there was good news for drivers, at least here in central Iowa last week, with word that a new Urbandale I-35/80 interchange will open this month after almost 2 years of construction. The new 100th Street interchange is scheduled to open October 15th if weather conditions don't delay the project's finishing touches. It will open a new access point to Urbandale's north side, and the city hopes it spurs new business development in the area. Of course, college football made big news around the state last week, as it always does this time of year. Iowa State defeated Oklahoma State University 48-42. The University of Iowa defeated Minnesota 48-31. And the University of Northern Iowa lost to North Dakota State 56-31. And that's your summary of news from around Iowa this past week. I'm Dennis Hart, reminding you that I'll be right back here Friday morning with a news summary from the pages of the Ames Tribune.
Thank you, Dennis, for those updates. Today, October 8th, is the second Monday in October, and that is the holiday that has been known as Columbus Day. But a number of states and municipalities have changed the name of the holiday to Indigenous Peoples Day. And today, Governor Kim Reynolds will sign an Indigenous Peoples Proclamation. Last year, there was an article in the Ames Tribune about Jenya Coffey, a first-grade teacher here in Ames who was using some interesting approaches to engage her students in learning about Native Americans at this time of year. Because it's fall again and the holidays of Columbus Day and Thanksgiving, I thought I would check back with Ms. Coffey to see what she was doing this year with her young students. Jenya, you're a teacher in Ames. Where do you teach and what grade?
I teach first grade at Sawyer Elementary School.
And how many years have you been doing that?
This is my third year teaching first grade, but it is my 12th year in the classroom.
Well, the reason we wanted to have you in today was because I had heard that you're doing some interesting and innovative things teaching your young students about Native Americans in particular. So because it's fall and we're coming up on Columbus Day and Thanksgiving holiday, I just wanted to get some thoughts from you on what sorts of things are you trying to do with your young students?
Really, last year was kind of the first time I tried to think about having a plan for how I wanted to discuss Native Americans in the classroom. One of our social studies standards is around national holidays. So I knew that I was going to need to talk about Columbus Day, Martin Luther King Day, things like that. And I just wanted to think about how could I do that. And so it was really around Thanksgiving last year that I started thinking about it.
So what did you do for Thanksgiving last year?
So last year I kind of just wanted to see what first graders know about Thanksgiving. So I just kind of did, you know, your basic, what questions do you have about Thanksgiving? Is that something you celebrate at home? What do you want to know about it? And it was just kind of interesting to learn that, in fact, first graders don't know a whole lot about the origins of Thanksgiving at all. So I was anticipating there being a lot of misconceptions mm-hmm. that I would need to go back and work on. But really, it was more that they were just sort of like, I don't know, we have turkey. You know, most of their questions were about food, and they didn't really seem to know much about the history of it. So I kind of wanted to use it as a way to introduce inquiry-based social studies instruction to them. I reached out to Iowa State and some other friends for some resources and just found a way to sort of alter a few primary source documents to make the language a little more appropriate to first grade. But then we tried to kind of look at a letter that was in someone's journal about the Harvest Festival as the place to start and figure out what can we learn from this letter. What does it tell us? What doesn't it tell us? What do we have to inference to figure out? And what do we think really went on? And then that was just our starting point. And we read some children's books and visited a few websites and learned as much as we could about what happened during what we call the first Thanksgiving. As we went along, started to notice what things were told and not told in a lot of the videos or books that are commonly come out with Scholastic or whatever. Just did some work around what parts of the story were told and not told and what seemed to be myths and what seemed to be misconceptions and what can we know and what do we have to guess about. So I really let them kind of lead where it went to. And we ended up just sort of creating a museum of images that we had found in our studies. And then I just let the kids talk about what they thought they could figure out from those images. And we kind of made a timeline of them. and invited parents and community members to come check out our museum when we were done. And that was sort of the overall first attempt at it.
And what kind of reaction did you get from the students and then from the people who came to see your museum exhibit?
Well, they absolutely loved the idea of history being this, like, investigation that you have to have and that you have to find clues and you have to have theories and try to figure things out. So they really enjoyed the idea of being investigators. And then once we did start learning a few things, they loved talking about how come that's not in this book or how come they keep saying this and they don't say this. So it was really, you know, why do they all dress like, you know, we talked about how the dress that you always see with the tall hats and the buckles, you know, really comes more from Abraham Lincoln's time period, not from what would have been the first Harvest Festival. So, you know, why do we keep seeing that? And so just figuring out some of that stuff. Also, I have quite a few international students in my classroom, usually, just being in Ames and having a lot of parents that work for the university or grad students. So I also reached out to parents before the unit started, just saying we're going to be exploring the, you know, the Harvest Festival. Do you have any Harvest Festivals in your culture or other holidays that you celebrate? Is Thanksgiving something you celebrate? Is there anything you'd like me to know about your practices that we could bring in? So, you know, I had a student from Russia, a student from India. So we also were able to talk a little bit about how the concept of a Harvest Festival isn't new to Thanksgiving, that those have been going on for thousands and thousands of years. So that was kind of fun to be able to pull in some experiences of people in the classroom.
And did the students also recognize that maybe the story or the perspective of the Native Americans wasn't as well represented in many of the readings and resources that you looked at?
Definitely. And I definitely tried to find a pretty balanced set. Uh-huh. And I think that one thing that I really want to do differently this year is I feel like we still came from it as a, what do we know about the white version of Thanksgiving? And then what can we learn about the Native American side? I'd like to center the experience more on the Native American perspective and then branch out from there, especially with Columbus Day. Like, I'm not going to start with Columbus Day. I'm going to start with Indigenous Peoples Day. And I'm going to start with having some explorations of what does it mean to be Native American and try to dispel some of those myths about there not being any Native Americans anymore as a place to start. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I want to decenter the white experience being normal and then the Native American experience being the other.
And so you haven't started on that this year. That's
coming
up next week.
We're getting going. So I just recently went to this arts integration workshop where I went through a session called Reading Portraits as Biographies. And we learned a little bit about looking at images and what you can figure out from them, which tied in really well to what we had done last year with our Thanksgiving images. So there's like a set of foundational lessons where you just are exploring what portraits are and what do we look for when we look at a portrait and what questions do they make us think of, and just getting some basic inferencing skills and ways to explore images, which I like to do with first graders when I can, because reading is not something we're doing a lot of yet. So this is a place that makes it really accessible for everybody. So it's taken us a little while to do some of those lessons. But then what I've done is I've come up with a set of images of Indigenous peoples from long time ago, from recent artwork done by them, artwork of them, characters from books. And we're just going to explore those images and kind of talk about what do we see that are the same and different about these different images as a way to sort of get our first glimpse at Indigenous peoples in our classroom. You know, and some of them being like from a couple weeks ago at homecoming with the Meskwaki tribe and, you know, way back to popular images from a long, long, long time ago.
And what's motivated you to want to do this work? Because obviously you're putting in a lot of extra effort and time to design, really a curriculum to do this. What's motivated you to do that?
Inquiry-based instruction is always something that has interested me. There's so much I don't know because I went through school when we didn't learn a lot of this kind of stuff. I'm very interested in not being this expert in front of the classroom that has to tell you how it is. I'm very interested in letting kids explore what they make of this all. So it's been a great way for me to not have to be an expert because we're all just exploring it. You know, I learned a ton in researching and getting ready for it last year. And when they ask me stuff, I don't usually know the answer. I mean, that's what historians do. They have to make guesses and figure stuff out and consult with other people. And I like the idea of making it developmentally appropriate, but still more like what you would do in that profession versus just me having you memorize the names of a bunch of holidays and when they happen.
And there's so many kinds of traditions associated with schools around Columbus Day and Thanksgiving, whether it's coloring in the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria, or dressing up as pilgrims and Native Americans and so on. Does a lot of that still go on in schools?
I think it's going to depend on the community and mm-hmm. the school district. I don't see a lot. I have not seen a lot of that here mm-hmm. In the Ames School District anyway. I won't say that it's not still mm-hmm. out there. I think, too, like we just have pressure to also be always teaching a lot of standards at once. And so you don't really have a lot of time for coloring sheets and sort of randomness. So if I'm thinking about this, I'm like, well, I got to teach them how to inference. I got to teach them what a primary source document is. We're always looking for ways to integrate a lot of heavy stuff into our work. So maybe that's helped mm-hmm. with that. I haven't seen a lot of it, but I still see it come through my Facebook feed. So I know it's going on elsewhere. I haven't seen a lot of it here in Ames.
That is remarkable that you're doing that kind of work on developing students' research skills in first grade.
Yeah, I like the idea. They know what a primary source document is. I mean, they make primary source documents. They love it. They love being an expert. First graders are all about feeling confident in their set of skills, you know, such that they are. Like, there's no reason to not start them off with that same kind of language.
Do you know if there are any other teachers, either at your school or in other schools in Ames, who are trying to do similar work?
Like, at my school anyway, my entire grade level is doing it all together this year, whereas last year I did it kind of by myself uh-huh. as a first go-through, but now my team is doing it with me. Also, a fourth grade teacher, Nicole Coronado, also went to the same arts integration workshop with me, so she's doing similar work with the images in her classroom, and they're going to maybe go someplace different with it since her standards don't revolve uh-huh. around national holidays like mine do, but she's going to find some ways to integrate it in there, and then we're going to try to find some ways for our classes to talk together about their learning. Beyond that, I'm not sure if it's uh-huh. if it's moved beyond the building at all, but definitely I was contacted by quite a few people after the article last year around Thanksgiving, just asking me to share more about what I had done.
So there's more teachers making these efforts at your school?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. And why do you think it's important that students learn beyond the traditional stories of these holidays?
I just think we have a much more diverse student population in Ames. We have a very diverse world, but it's very segregated in certain ways still. And I want to help my students learn to think for themselves and to have their own ideas about how the world works. So, I mean, my driving force is always just I want to keep things truthful, you know, developmentally appropriate, but truthful. I don't see any reason in reinforcing stereotypes or apologizing for anything. I just want to present what we know, what we think we know, what we want to know, and see where it goes. Because I think they're going to need those skills to interact outside of the school. So it's important for me to help them learn to think for themselves within the school.
And so there hasn't been any pushback of the kind saying that this kind of learning is inappropriate or these topics are inappropriate for young students.
You know, I was nervous about that last year. And I will say, like, the article was published online. There were definitely some, like, comments from strangers that I don't know that didn't seem very happy with the idea. But also they didn't read the article and weren't actually talking about what we'd really done in the classroom. I was a little nervous about how parents would take to it. But I think the fact that I reach out and let them know what's going on first and ask them for their own traditions. And I'm not undoing any traditions that they might have. I mean, after we finished our Thanksgiving unit, when we went off to Thanksgiving break and came back, then we talked about, now what things did your family do to celebrate or not do? And let's, you know, notice what traditions are important in our own families and share those. So it's not negating anything that they might be doing at home. I mean, I'm sure there's people that don't talk to me that maybe had a problem with it, but I haven't felt any pushback from my school district or parents of my students or anything like that.
Are there other ways in your teaching that you're trying to pull in the idea of representation of other groups or fairness and justice toward other groups?
Well, I don't know if it is that straightforward, but in Ames we have responsive classroom as our sort of overall philosophy for like behaviors and social emotional learning, which has the concepts of cooperation, assertion, responsibility, empathy, and self-control. So those are terms that I try to infuse into everything that I do. And I think assertion, you know, standing up for what you believe in, standing up for other people, and empathy, putting yourself in other people's shoes. I mean, those two things relate very much to some ideas that have to do with social justice and advocacy. Mm-hmm. So I want to make sure that as a first grader, we're learning how to cooperate, how we're all together, how we're working together, how we're standing up for what's right and what we believe in, how we're thinking about how other people feel, how we have a responsibility to each other. So I think all of those concepts tie in well to social justice work. I don't know if I've gone as far as I could to make that a more direct connection for them. But those are concepts that are important to me. But again, I always want it to center on them and our community in the classroom and how they want to look at the world.
So you'll take how this goes this year and see what you want to change and do for next year?
Yeah, and see what the students want to do and where they want to go with it. Like, you know, last year for Thanksgiving, they had a much bigger interest in food than I would have suggested. So we did a lot of research about what they used to eat at the, you know, mm-hmm. First Harvest Festival. And so I don't like to plan things completely because it needs to be student driven for it to be mm-hmm. interesting and important to them. So I'm excited to see where they take it. And I'm excited that some other teachers are doing it with me because then I'm going to have an even greater group of ideas to think about as we move forward. And my, you know, plan is just to take it a little further each year. You know, I wasn't quite ready to do much of anything a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. We dabbled a little bit last year. We're going to try a little bit more this year and we'll just see how it builds.
And are you planning to have another kind of exhibit or something?
Yeah, I think we're going to, at least for the Thanksgiving, we're going to do that same thing where we invite the families. It's kind of nice because it's right before break, kind of, mm-hmm. and it's a nice time of year to have families in and see what we're up to, and the kids are so proud of their work. And so, yeah, we'll do that again.
Fantastic. Well, I'm impressed. I don't remember my daughter experiencing things like this and this kind of learning when she was in first grade. So I think it's really wonderful that you've figured out ways to do this with young people.
Thank you.
That was Jenya Coffey, a first grade teacher at Sawyer Elementary School in Ames. And you are listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. At the Christian Peterson Art Museum at ISU, there is currently an exhibit called Unpacked, Refugee Baggage. KHOI reporter Joy Beadleston brings us the story behind that exhibit, which is both a visual and audio exhibit.
So this exhibition is about 9 suitcases with detailed interiors that tell the stories of different refugees from all around the world. Mohammed was a graduate of Iowa State in about 2009 in architecture. He is from Syria. While he is not himself a refugee, he can't go home. And when he first came here, he was on a single entry visa, which really made it difficult to ever go home and be able to get back in a timely fashion, especially as a student where, you know, you're on a schedule. And so he's only been back in 2011, right before everything, the Civil War began. And so he's only been back at that one point. And at this point, his whole family has left Syria, including a sister and brother-in-law who did become refugees. His brother-in-law decided that he needed to leave and took a boat across to Europe and is now settled in Sweden. He's actually opened his own firm. So he started creating art because he missed his home. He missed Syria. He loved living here. He was happy here, but he missed the sounds and the images of what he knew. And so he started creating very personal arts, these little tiny renditions and depictions of buildings and interiors and the places he knew. As he was working more and more on this, his friends decided he needed to show it. And so he started showing his art. And in the past couple years, he started working with a young student named Ahmed Badr, who's an Iraqi refugee, who is in college now in Connecticut at Wesleyan. Ahmed collects stories, and he already has been working on collecting refugee stories, especially kids and things like that, to tell their story. And so he worked to collect these different stories. And so each suitcase has an audio component where you hear 60 to 90 seconds of the refugee telling their own story. And this is taken from a whole bunch of tapes, so they had to edit it down. And then Mohammed created kind of that moment in front of you in miniature. And each suitcase kind of has this interior that almost looks like it's been destructed and it's gone through. But then you see the little pieces that they're talking about and you're listening to. So they might be referencing the basement where they were teaching children or the home that they had to run from and left their tea sitting on the table and things like that.
They coordinated together to make this exhibit. So Muhammad did all the intricate details. And I noticed he has all these suitcases in the middle. And I'm like, there's my dad's suitcase. And there's the Samsonite. And it's representative of suitcases from almost every decade. It's interesting because it seems like there's ones from the 1800s and every the 1920s, 30s, 40s up to the, looks like the 70s, 80s maybe.
He collects suitcases, obviously, for this project and just in general, and so people have started giving him suitcases. And he doesn't have one. He has one, he says, that I think is from someone's great-great-great-grandparent that was an immigrant from Germany in the 18th century at home. But he also goes to vintage shops. He lives in the Northeast. But there is one work of art on the wall, Freshta. Her story is in her mother's suitcase. Mm-hmm. So her mother gave him that suitcase to build her story.
I saw that. I thought that was really amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, it makes it more personal.
Yeah.
So that was nice that he was able to get that. And I noticed, too, that different countries are represented besides Muhammad and Ahmed's countries. There's other countries represented. Did you want to talk about any of those interviews and those other people that represent those suitcases?
Sure. So, you know, while I think everyone thinks about just Syria having a crisis right now, it's obviously many more countries and many countries that have been going through this for decades. Including the Democratic Republic of Congo is on there. Sudan has been having civil wars for a very long time. There's Afghani kids in there, Iraqi, Syria. And so each, it's very interesting because they all have unique stories, but they're all doing the same thing, leaving because there's no way for them to live in that place anymore. And they have to go somewhere else. And some of the stories are incredibly heartbreaking. One of them, I kind of refer to a lot, was the story of Joseph. I believe he's from the Congo, who was a lawyer and his father was a judge. And his son was kidnapped and he had to leave and has no idea if his son's alive or dead. Yet still is here driving Ubers and cabs and Lyft and making a life and has to live. And so it's really important to see that it's not just what you hear in the media. It's not just, oh, this crisis, it's only Syria, all these Syrians, or you know, all the Middle East. It's all over the place, and you know they're everywhere, and they could be people you know, and it could be your family one day. And so it's important to think about that you know, we're lucky, and we need to not forget that sometimes.
I did want to say, I did listen to Muhammad and the other stories, Ahmed, and they were talking about how this was a way to help people get related to what it's like for them to be a refugee. And there's really great stories, too, about triumph, about coming here and how much they've, you know, overcome. And some of them have, you know, become very successful. And I thought those were kind of like the American Dream story, too, so it's really interesting. So do you want to speak to that at all about how some of the refugees, have people reacted in a way that they're like, oh, I didn't know this, that I've seen the exhibit?
Sure. I definitely think that was, I mean, that's one of the main things. It's humanizing the refugee experience. I think that we all hear so much about refugees and see images, but there's no understanding that these are people, they're individuals, they each have their own story, they're each unique, and yes, they are all running from a similar situation, but they're each doing it for their own reasons, and their own needs, and their own dreams, and it's trying to make that point that these are each different people, and their stories are different, and let's listen to their stories. Because you relate on an individual basis. When you just hear, oh, there's 68 million refugees, it's a number you can't even think about or comprehend. So you just see it as a mass of these people who, why are they trying to get away from something? So each of these stories really makes you realize that you could have something in common with this person. You both might be interested in the same thing, or you both might want the same things out of your life. And the great thing is, a lot of these people, like you said, are coming to this country or other countries, and they're succeeding, and they're attempting to become part of the community and to give back to the community that is welcoming them. Muhammad likes to talk about his brother-in-law, who is in Sweden in a small town and has opened his own architecture firm now. And they don't have a lot of firms there, so he's doing great and he's giving back and he's contributing. And that is part of the situation, is that we're told that these people are living off of us and that we're giving them everything and they're giving us nothing, when that's absolutely not the true story. And then next Thursday, October 11th, we'll have two speakers talking about their own refugee experience. They both work here on campus. And were refugees when they were younger, and so they'll be speaking about their experience.
What responses have you had that maybe moved you or you were surprised at that went through this exhibit?
So this actually, my coworker, my past coworker, was here when she first came in, but I met her when she came in the second time. She, I believe she teaches on campus, and she's originally from Egypt, and she, when you're in the exhibition, you'll hear a lot of noises, and that is recordings that Muhammad took last time he was in Syria, and that includes the call to prayer in several different iterations. And she heard that in the hallway, and she kind of double-backed, because she doesn't hear that in America, and she was, like, she couldn't understand, this is what I hear at home, this is a piece of home, which is exactly how Muhammad sees it. That's a piece of home. It's a daily occurrence. Every, you know, five times a day, and so it's something you hear all the time, and you don't realize how much you miss it until it's gone. And so she heard it, and she doubled back and came in and went through the entire exhibition, and kind of left happy, but in tears too, because it's so, especially for someone, you know, this is like home, and it's moving, and to hear the stories and to understand that these are people that, you know, live in the same lives as you, live in the same area as you sometimes now, what they've gone through, and to have a moment to kind of take time and listen to their stories. I think it's really moving for a lot of people.
Okay, and there's also a website that people can go to. So could you give us the website? Because I know people, if they can't make it here, there's a website that'll tell some of the stories and show the suitcases, some of them, and, you know, have information about each person that's telling their story.
Sure. So it's www.unpackedrefugee.com. And that is Muhammad Ahmed's full exhibition webpage. And so you can go there and look at each work of art, too, and hear video clips of the stories, too.
And also I saw there's a book in the back, also by where they ask you the question about what you would take. It's like some clips from some articles. So it looks like he was even given a story in The New Yorker and some other impressive articles. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so he's been written up in The New York Times and The New Yorker. He lives in New Haven, Connecticut, so not too far from New York. And, you know, starting with some of his personal art and what he was making and going into Unpacked, including also other NPR interviews. He was on IPR here with Charity Nebbe, which a lot of people heard, but he's had other NPR interviews and kind of a lot of really good press, I think, because things he's doing are beautiful, but also very timely, very important. And art is a very good way, a great medium to talk about these things without kind of rhetoric or anger or, you know, stepping away from all of that. You're able to just look at the art and discuss this. And so I think people are really gravitating to these creators.
Thanks to Joy Beadleston for bringing us that interview with Adrienne Jeanette, curator of the exhibit called Unpacked Refugee Baggage, which is at the Christian Peterson Art Museum at ISU until October 19th. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We've been joined in the studio by Keith Morgan for his monthly segment. Keith is from the Story County Emergency Management. Thanks for being with us, Keith, as always.
Good morning.
And you brought a couple of other folks to speak with us this morning. Welcome to Audie Maxey, the Ballard School Superintendent.
Good morning.
And Ned Miller, the District Safety Coordinator from Ballard Schools.
Good morning.
And our topic today is school safety and security. And Keith, you reminded us that it's a topic that's particularly relevant now because the Iowa legislature passed a law last year with certain requirements related to school security. So tell us first about that law.
Well, the law requires that all schools have what they call high-quality emergency plans, and specifically that those emergency plans must cover natural disasters and the active shooter. Now, most of our schools have done a lot of the safety planning beforehand, but this law was very specific in some of the requirements that are out there. And it also pointed towards not just the school administration, but the school boards themselves to be actively involved in this. Some of the provisions for it are processes for any time that that either a school administrator, school parents, or anybody starts to feel that there is a situation that could create a threat. There's ways to report that. There's requirements for to practice some of these techniques that are going to be put into this plan at each facility that's out there. So it had a lot of things that many of our schools were already doing, but it put it into code and gave it a little bit more strength.
And maybe added some new things that hadn't been so specific before.
Exactly. The active shooter part was something that was not spelled out in code. Even natural disasters, there were requirements for fire drills and those kind of activities, but it expanded it on out to cover some of those other events.
And Adi and Ned, you're charged with implementing the response to this new legislation. What do you feel are the top risks facing schools today?
I'll go first, Ned. That's a tricky question because as you go through prioritizing risks, there are certainly things like weather events that we know are more likely to happen, barring the less common, really serious events like a large-scale tornado or wind event like that. The damage is relatively minor in those cases, but they're more frequent. So we certainly have to prioritize those and account for those. And then you alluded to an active shooter event. Those are significantly less likely to happen. However, the impact can be quite dramatic, as we all know. And so it's also important to prioritize those. So it's not really – there's not a simple answer to that question. In fact, what I would say is it's important to account for all of those events and have a plan for all of those events and then decide over time what are you going to focus on initially and then just continue to work the plan. And you're going to start to work down to some of those events that are much less likely, and maybe the risks and the fallout isn't as severe, but you need to focus on those as well.
Ned, you've been in school security for a while, not at Ballard, but at other places you mentioned. Have the kinds of risks that you're paying attention to changed over the years?
I don't think they've changed, but I think, if you will, the emphasis the target gets moved sometimes. And when I say that, you know, right now, active shooter response is a hot topic. And
yeah, it's
talk
on everyone's
that.
Mind.
And like
yeah.
Adi said, it's infrequent, but when it happens, it's horrific. And the response and lives are changed forever. And so you have to be able to respond to that. So I don't think there's anything new necessarily. I think what we need to, as Adi referred to, we need to have people prepared to be able to respond. I like to use the term situational awareness so that you can, and there's a lot of the things that you do that are similar to all of the responses to many events. And so, you know, get some kind of a checklist and a hierarchy, if you will, of, you know, life safety, student safety, scene control, and start stepping through that and get it so that no matter what the event, you start checking off these boxes that are similar.
What will this legislation and the new policies or expectations that Keith mentioned change for Ballard schools in particular?
I think the good news is it won't change things very much at all. In fact, we have a school board that is very, very committed to school safety. They demonstrate their commitment by putting resources towards that and giving us the opportunity to really spend time and work with outside experts on honing our plans, making sure that they reflect the very best of what we know in responding to safety incidents, and also by dedicating resources to a position like district safety coordinator and getting Ned Miller on board. So we've been involved in this work. I'm happy to say that my understanding of what's happening in other districts, it's a priority there. I network with superintendents mm-hmm. in other districts. It's a priority there. I think the state, with this new law stepping up, frankly, I appreciate them bringing attention to that because we're about student learning, but we also fully understand that parents entrust us with their kids and that, frankly, their safety is our top priority.
Because it's a school, I imagine there's differences from other places that these risks can be encountered, other facilities. What's different about, you kind of alluded to that, in that the parents are trusting you with the safety of their children. But what else is different about dealing with safety and security in schools than other kinds of contexts?
Well, I think the difference that I see in the previous 10 years, I was more involved at the post-secondary level. And you have less control over those students and their reactions and their response because of the freedom that they have to come and go. Where, and Adi uses a term for this that I can't recall right now, but, you know, at the K-12 level, the students are, if you will, under our umbrella all day long from time to time. And so we have to be responsive to that and responsible to that to make sure. So other than that, I'm not sure there's any great differences other than, you know, parents expect their kids to be able to go to school and be safe. And it's our job to do our best to respond to that and make sure that they are.
I'll add to that. You raise an important point. Yeah, the safety procedures that would be in place at Wellmark, for example, or a large corporate, those are different because they're adults. And the information that you can put in those folks' hands, the way you present the information, the way you train it, the way you drill it, is going to be very different. And it's an important point that we recognize, I'll use Ballard as an example, we have a K-2 building to a high school building. So the way we work with our students and help them understand safety with a group of kindergartners is obviously very different than a group of seniors. Ned might have a specific example of that.
Well, the active shooter is a topic that's out there and we talk about. And the example is that Ballard and many schools use a protocol called ALICE, Alert, Lockdown, Inform, Counter, and Evacuate, which is a run, hide, fight, if you will, response. But how you teach kindergartners through second grade is different than you do third through fourth and sixth through ninth or whatever, you know, because you just can't you have to bring it to them in terms that they can understand, but also that we don't want to put – we're not a fear monger. We want them to respond, but to also feel safe. And we use when the Story County folks come in and do training at our kindergarten through second grade buildings, they use a small book that's been put together for that age level. And the teachers take more responsibility, if you will, at that than we're in the high school. You give the students some responsibility and expectations of what they can do also.
The idea of not creating undue anxiety and among students, I would think, would be important, especially at the younger grades, but all grades, really,
exactly.
I think. So balancing that need for awareness with not becoming fearful. Well,
the terms you use, the training you use, the drills you use can be, as the older they are, the more, if you will, specific you can be on responses, and terms that you use can be more forceful, if you will, where the younger they are, you need to get them to not be afraid but be aware. Situational awareness is for everybody.
I want to ask you this question because many of our listeners are not from the Ballard School District. So families or parents from other districts may be hearing this and wondering, what's my school doing or what's my district doing? So are there questions or things that parents should be asking or be aware of in their districts?
I alluded to this earlier, and while I don't know specifics, I know enough in my working with other districts that the campus safety is a priority in all the districts around here that your listeners reside in. And really, the questions, there is state code in place, and oftentimes in a district, there's a policy in place that ensures the confidentiality of these policies for obvious reasons, that we don't just disseminate our plans, our response plans to anybody that asks. However, that said, it's certainly appropriate for a parent to ask a question. And quite frankly, I'd start at the lowest level. Talk to your teacher about it. Talk to your building principal about it. And just ask, are these plans in place? are drills and training taking place? And I'm very confident that the answer that, that they will get is yes. Mm-hmm. But those are the questions to ask, and they're certainly reasonable questions.
Keith, from your perspective, how do you work with schools, and what's the role of emergency management in working with schools around these efforts?
Well, starting at the broader level, even before this, 3 years ago, we brought all those schools together, and we had a bit of a planning session. And we talked about the basics and the principles on their planning, the role of the superintendent versus the role of a principal versus the role of a teacher, and how do you put a plan together and work through it. And then after that, there have been times that we've gone out to individual schools and done walkthroughs to work with them on safety. For instance, up in the Roland Story School system, they actually brought together committees to look at safety, and we facilitated bringing in people from Homeland Security at the state level. And we did an evaluation which actually translated into specific recommendations that were incorporated into a bonding issue to enhance the security and safety of the schools. So, again, we can't do it for them, and the initiative has to come from within the school district itself, and they have to want to bring together all of the players, not just within the school, but their law enforcement and their local fire departments. For instance, Roland Story has law enforcement that's in Story City, but also has to work with Story County deputies. They have two different fire districts, two different EMS districts. So it's a difficult task, but if we work through a process and we take it and prioritize what we're going to work at, each of the schools can get keep working towards enhancing their security and also adapting to whatever changes come.
What role do parents and or community members or students even play in helping to develop these plans? I know some of it has to be done by experts, but is there room for input by parents or students?
The short answer is yes. And the way that input is provided is simply, I'll use students as an example. The way that input is provided is because they will participate in the plans and in the training and the implementation. They're actively a part of the drills, and we expect that as we execute these drills and these trainings, that as questions arise, things that maybe we haven't considered, that students can raise those, staff can raise those. And in fact, that's frankly the value in doing those trainings, because when you involve a lot of people, you can begin to account for things that, that maybe one individual or a small group has not considered. And really, it's not so much the things with, I'll use fire drill as an example. Those are more common. They're pretty straightforward. But it's some of the more obscure mm-hmm. things that we would train for, where a student or a staff member might raise a question that would cause us to say, yeah, we need to think mm-hmm. about that.
Mm-hmm. You know, just to follow up on that a bit, after every event, whether it's a drill or an actual event of some kind, it's common, and Ballard does this, an after-action report or mm-hmm. a discussion to what did we do right, what went well, what can we change. And just in the short time that I've been involved since summer, we've made some changes in some of the protocols, and it was in a tornado drill. I'll give you a quick example of how you get feedback, although it wasn't intentional. At one of our schools, when you evacuate, the fire doors will close automatically inside the building, which is code, and they're supposed to do that. One of the kindergarten grades, the fire door closed, and the one little girl stopped and stood there and faced the door until somebody came and got her. Well, the teacher came back to get her, and all the other kids just followed the teacher like little ducks in a row to go back there,
because that's what they learned to do. Yeah.
But we learned, the teacher, you know, stop. You guys stay right there. I'm going back to get Susie. Or whatever.
Well, thank you all for being here. It's been very informative and gives us lots to think about. I've been talking with Keith Morgan from Story County Emergency Management, Adi Maxey from the Ballard Schools, and he's the superintendent, and Ned Miller, a consultant with Ballard Schools. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also listen to our shows online at khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.